ॐ पार्थाय प्रतिबोधिदां भगवता नारायणेन स्वयं व्यासेन ग्रथितां पुराणमुनिना मध्ये महाभारतम् अद्वैतामृतवर्षिणीं भगवतीं अष्टादशाध्यायिनीं अम्ब त्वामनुसन्दधामि भगवद्गीते भवद्वेषिणीम्। यं ब्रह्मा वरुणेन्द्ररुद्रमरुदस्तुन्नन्ति दिव्यैस्तवैः वेदैः साङ्गपदक्रमोपनिषदैः गायन्ति यं सामगाः ध्यानावस्थिततद्गतेन मनसा पश्यन्ति यं योगिनो यस्यान्तं न विदुःसुरासुरगणाः देवाय तस्मै नमः। We are continuing the discussion on the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. So from 55th verse to 72nd verse, there is a description, an elaborate description of the characteristics of an enlightened person, a spiritually enlightened person. How does a spiritually enlightened person deal with this world, with the realities of life, with the problems of family? In fact, how does he interact? In what way is he different from somebody who is not spiritually enlightened? What's the difference between an enlightened person, a wise person who has some spiritual ideal that guides his life, and those who don't have any such higher ideal? So that's a topic discussed in these 18 verses of the Bhagavad Gita. And we have now reached the 71st verse, and the 72nd is the last. So in the 72nd verse, the teacher tells us who attains peace of mind. So, the word used is shanti. So, vihaya kaman yasarvan pumam sharadi nispraha nirmamo nirahangara sa shanti madigachadi. Shanti means peace. Now, by the word peace, the author doesn't mean a kind of satisfaction. We feel satisfaction when we get something that we are looking for. When we accomplish something in life, we feel a kind of satisfaction. But this shanti, the word Sanskrit word shanti, that is used in Buddhist tradition, either religious tradition also, many of the oriental religious traditions use the word shanti. So shanti means a kind of inner contentment. When you have that contentment, it's not that you keep quiet somewhere, you don't work, you don't strive for anything else, you become insensitive to your needs, or you become lethargic. No. Even in the midst of working for fulfilling the needs of daily life, even in the midst of being engaged in facing the challenges and problems of life, he is able to connect himself with something higher than mind and body. Because the body can never be perfect by its very nature. And mind normally is very, very unstable. It doesn't mean that instability or anxiety or wavering nature are essential or inherent to our mind, not at all. Actually, anxiety is something alien to our mind. Instability is something alien. But frequently what happens when the mind is dragged into, when it connects with various sense objects in the world, through the eyes, the ears, the sense of touch, the sense of smell, and the sense of taste, 5 senses of perception. Then the mind is never really stable. It becomes wavering, it changes, it becomes agitated. It goes after certain things and it tries to withdraw away from certain things and it goes after certain things. And if it's not able to attain what it is trying to attain, then becomes disappointed. This is essentially the kind of mind that we normally have to deal with. But Vedanta tells us this is not the real nature of the mind. Mind in its true inherent nature is one with Atman. So how to identify this mind in its true nature? When we try to link the mind to something transcendental, something higher, in Vedanta we call Atman or the soul or the universal spiritual reality that is omnipresent, that is all-pervading, that is immanent, present in all of us, which is of the nature of bliss, eternal bliss, never agitated, always in a state of equilibrium. This is the real nature of Atman or soul. And when the mind is linked to this transcendental reality, then mind becomes completely peaceful. That's why psychological problems can never have permanent solutions at psychological level. We cannot solve the problems of the mind at the mental level. We have to go beyond the mind to find a real solution to the problems of the mind. So that's why here the Lord says that person who is free from longing, he may be a billionaire, a trillionaire, he may be the richest man in the world, richest woman in the world, but in his mind he knows it is not going to last for long. So when we remember that real fact in our mind, then mind is actually detached. It doesn't become obsessed. It doesn't become too much obsessed with the money we possess. Not that we will throw away all that we have got. Not at all. Even in the midst of handling the problems of the world, the compulsions and challenges and obligations of the world, if we keep in our mind nirmama, well, it doesn't really belong to me, because the real I is something beyond body and mind. The real I is not the owner of the world. The real I is not going to be the enjoyer of the world. The real I is something transcendental, the all-pervading soul, the divine reality, present everywhere and present in everything. So, this is called omnipresence, immanence and transcendence. That's the language of Meister Eckhart. It's used in Vedanta very frequently. So, such a person is able to enjoy peace even while facing all the problems and challenges of the world. That's what the author says. Vikaya kaman yan kaman yas sarvan pumam sharadi nisprakha. So nirmamo nirahankara sa shanti madigachdi. He attains peace. Again, peace doesn't mean absence of war. The opposite of war. Peace here is a positive, natural, spontaneous, spiritual state of mind, where mind is linked to something transcendental. Now, in the Hindu metaphysics, this is explained in Hindu philosophical ontology. The whole existence is approached from 3 different angles. The absolute reality, which we call Atman, the all-pervading self, the soul, and the empirical reality, that is the changing reality, this world, and all that we normally consider to be the most precious thing, all the money, wealth, status, things that we know will disappear one day. Now, this belongs to empirical reality, and there is another reality, conceptual reality, things that we may experience for some time only as an idea, like dreams. In our mind, we may have conceptual realities. Now, how does a spiritually enlightened person look at the world? That is the philosophical foundation of this piece. He is living in the world. He's a family person, maybe. He may be a very busy executive. In fact, some of the greatest teachers of ancient Vedic tradition were reigning monarchs, emperors and kings who were very busy in their life. They had a lot of work to do, a lot of challenges to face. So many of the teachers like Panchala, Shubhati, Janaka, these were all philosopher kings of ancient Vedic times. Now, they were not men living in a forest hermitages. They were reigning monarchs who were living in palaces. And they were some of the most enlightened teachers of this art of enjoying peace, even in the midst of obligations and duties. Because even in the midst of facing the realities of worldly life, empirical life, they kept in their mind, rather they never forgot the fact that these things are changing phenomena. Very often we expect impermanence from things that we know to be essentially impermanent. We expect them to be permanent. That's what happens to people when they feel great depression and anxiety. They feel that the world should be always providing an unbroken supply of sensual enjoyment. It can never happen, really. The world is subject to changes. Everyone knows this, to be very frank. So they are able to look upon all these worldly empirical things as part of the changing phenomena. It is called Vyavaharika Satta in Sanskrit, Vedanta philosophy. It means something that we actually face in our everyday practical encounters. It is changing. It is bound to change. Now, behind these changing phenomena, there is an unchanging reality, which Vedanta calls Atman. In different theistic traditions, you may call God's grace or whatever, any higher spiritual state of experience that is permanent, that is unchanging, that is immortal. So once we face a problem, and when once the cause of the problem worries us too much, then we should remember that this is its nature. So that's why the second verse, these are interrelated verses. Esha brahmi sthiti partha nainam prape vimukhyati sthitvasyam antakale api brahma nirvanam prichyati. So the word nirvana used in Buddhist tradition is also actually originally used in the Gita, which is 3,000-4,000 years before the Buddhist religion. You know, it is belongs nearly 5,000 years back, 3,000 BC. So, Esha Brahmi, this state of lasting peace and contentment, once you get this, once you become aware of this unchanging reality, then what happens? We become established in that peace, in that absolute reality. Then, when one's body comes to an end, you become one with the absolute reality. It is the absolute liberation. Brahma Nirvana means realization of Brahman, the ultimate spiritual, transcendental, mystical experience, the total identity with the absolute reality. So now the question may arise, is this peace or this higher transcendental reality something that should be reserved when we are going to die? So that is a very important thing. Is peace or the highest spiritual enlightenment something that we experience only at the end of our life? No. Vedanta doesn't say that. Vedanta tells us that even when we are living in this world, we can attain this. And once we attain this, we can continue living in this world. And so a spiritually enlightened person, like a Buddha, an example. Buddha was a king, was a prince. He left his kingdom when he was 28 years old, walked 1200 miles, sat under a tree, and did this meditation, penance, contemplation for several years, and he became a Buddha, the enlightened one. And then he did not go and sleep somewhere. Actually, Buddha became hyperactive after he became Buddha. He may not have worked as hard before he got this spiritual enlightenment. You look at Christ. Christ really started his work only after he reappeared for the long period of seclusion. So you find this in the life of the great sages of ancient India. You find once they attain this highest spiritual goal, it doesn't make them inactive, insensitive to problems of the world. Rather, they start looking at the world and the problems of the world from a different perspective. The only difference, apparently, at the superficial level, is that they don't worry too much. That's the main thing. I mean, these problems of this world is not a big deal for them, to put in modern language. They do have problems. I don't think there was anybody in the world who did not have problems. But the way we look at the problem, that's the area of difference. So there is an interesting statement in the well-known book, you know, Evelyn Underhill's Practical Mysticism, a well-known classic, one of these, it published somewhere 1914-15 those days. He says, so something is attributed to quotation of Eckhart, the greatest Christian mystic who lived in 13th century Germany. He says, so there is a dialogue. What brought you to perfection? So the answer from the mystic, from a spiritual seeker, came, my union with God, for I cannot rest in anything that was less than God. So God is the only resting place. So God, again, in Vedantic tradition, God should not be understood as somebody who creates this world and sits somewhere and supervises our actions. Well, a creator God is real, is accepted in Vedanta. But as we evolve in our own spiritual life, our understanding of God also evolves. So even according to Eckhart, you know, the creator God is only an approximation, an imperfect approximation to the transcendental reality that is beyond the Holy Trinity, according to Eckhart. Now, Eckhart lived in the 13th century. We are reading the scripture that was written around 2000 BC. So, that's why there is an interesting, very interesting statement coming from the commentator who actually made Bhagavad Gita a world spiritual classic. If he had not written a commentary on this text, we won't be discussing Gita today. And he lived in 8th century AD. His name is Shankaracharya. So he, I am quoting from him, I should translate in English. Stitva asyam brahmyam idoktayam antakale api ante vayasi api brahmanirvanam brahmanirvadi moksham richadi gachadi kima vaktavyam brahmacharyat eva sanyasi yavajivam yo brahmani eva vadishthadi sa brahmanirvanam richadi iti. This is Shankaracharya's commentary. What it means is, the text tells you, once you realize the reality of this all-pervading spiritual divine truth, which is your own nature, once you realize this, Once you, at the end of your life, you become one with it. Then he says, you don't have to wait to the last moment. This can be experienced by any person who is willing to practice certain spiritual disciplines, certain disciplines involving restraining the senses and mind, a discerning wisdom, a sense of detachment towards sensual pleasures, and a strong longing for spiritual enlightenment and liberation. For those who develop these skills and then practice meditation, contemplation, prayer, reading holy scriptures, even when they are very, very young, it is possible. And he says that is much better. Religion and spirituality should not be delayed, should not be reserved for the old age homes. It is something to be actually taught to students going to schools and colleges and universities. That's what Shankaracharya, the 8th century commentator, says. He says, Kimu Vaktavya, what to speak of those who had the good fortune to get these spiritual ideas, even when they are going to schools and colleges and universities before they start a career. That's why he says, Kimu Vaktavya, what to speak of? How blessed it, what a great blessing it would be if people can imbibe these higher spiritual values, which will help them to look upon the whole humanity as one spiritual family, and their own life is full of bliss and lasting peace, so that this message can and should be taught to those who are at the beginning of their life. That is the great commendatory statement. Now we can perhaps find certain interesting aspects of this philosophy of spiritual enlightenment. As I mentioned earlier, the spiritual enlightenment is not something that we reserve for the last stage in our life. It is something that we hold in one hand when we are working with the other hand in our everyday duties and responsibilities. So, and this idea, that is, on the one hand, that there is one all-pervading divine spiritual reality present everywhere. It is present in all of us. That's our true nature. And all the problems that we face in this world, at the world of mind and the phenomenal world, are there, but they won't be there tomorrow. These problems are there today, but they are not everlasting. They won't be there tomorrow. Frequently, the main cause of most of the problems we are facing is, we often forget that the problem we are facing today is as impermanent as the happiness or enjoyment that we are going through today. Very often, we forget the impermanence of the unpleasant situation. We may remember the impermanence of the pleasant situation, so that's why people become anxious and worried. But we forget, sometimes we forget, that this unpleasant situation also is impermanent. So then why should we worry too much about it? But the point is, we can avoid worrying too much only if we give up our desire to enjoy all the time. We can avoid worry only if we give up our desire for enjoyment all the time, because enjoyment is not going to be everlasting, and its opposite also is not going to be everlasting. So in the earlier verses, Lord Krishna outlined this concept of Swadharma, how we go about our day-to-day duties and obligations, and how we face the realities and challenges and obligations of life around us. So we discussed this concept of Swadharma. So Swadharma actually means looking at every work we do, not only physical work, every kind of duties, okay, words we speak, physical deeds we do, thoughts we think, these are all activities. And all these activities leave a residual effect on the mental system. And that becomes a tendency, that becomes an impression, and that again influences our future actions. Now, if we look upon our whole duty and profession and other responsibilities as our Swadharma, means our appointed duty, the way we justify our skills, our existence, and our responsibilities. So how to face the reality of an unpleasant duty? Something that we don't want to do, but we have to do. In fact, the original Gita itself is related to this question. That student puts one question to Krishna. How to face a situation in which you have to do something which you don't want, which you don't like, which is what society expects from you, which are what actually everyone expects from you, but you don't want it, you don't like it, you don't like the problems that come along with that. So Lord Krishna's answer is, do it as a duty. So if you can look upon everything we do with a sense of sanctity and sacredness as a way and method, not only to get the result, but also as a means for attaining our own spiritual evolution, then every action becomes a help, a tool in our hands. It helps us, well, I have done my duty, I have done my responsibility. In fact, that actually energizes the metabolism. It brings down the stress level, the anxiety level. If we can do something that we are obliged to do, and to such an extent that we get a kind of a spontaneous satisfaction, contentment. Well, I have done my best. Once we get this feeling, that actually is as a healing effect on the mind. And in Sanskrit, I repeated this earlier, we are coming to the end of this chapter, so I am trying to recapitulate some of the ideas discussed earlier. It is called in Sanskrit, Kritakrityata and Kritarthata. Sanskrit, in the ancient Sanskrit language, Kritakrityata means a kind of deep, everlasting, healing conviction. Well, I have done what I ought to have done. And Kritarthata means, well, I have attained what I ought to have attained. So you don't get overjoyed. If you are looking for happiness all the time, then we are doomed to face the reality of unhappiness at some point, at some stage in our life. So once we put all these together, and reduce everything to this idea, where it is my Swadharma, it is my duty. And in an earlier session, in the new temple, in a discussion, I mentioned this. It goes far beyond Kantian concept of categorical imperative. So Immanuel Kant, the 18th century German philosopher, he developed this idea of perfectionism and duty. So morality and immorality, righteousness or its opposite, all can always be justified in the context of duty, whether it helps us to fulfill our duty. And duty is linked to the idea of a universal moral imperative, which he called categorical imperative. That's a great ideal. That actually is a great concept of secular moral universal order. So that was a great contribution from Kant. But Bhagavad Gita tells us that along with that, you also do that duty with a sense of sanctity and sacredness. It is my way to justify my skills, my duties. So there are certain work that we have to do. A doctor has to do his work. It's obvious. That is the training he has received. So by virtue of qualifications, training and fitness, we may have to do certain things. And the compulsions and demands of society, that also can be a factor behind our idea of duty and responsibility. All these are different factors. But all these, if we do with a sense of sanctity and sacredness, not only for attaining the result, but in the process, we also attain a kind of inner peace, serenity and contentment, then it becomes Swadharma or Karma Yoga. In the next chapter, that is a main topic to be discussed. That's what we are going to discuss in the third chapter. The third chapter deals with Karma Yoga. So I shall explain this as a prelude. So Gita, Bhagavad Gita outlines, it gives an outline of different human temperaments and how these temperaments influence our attitude towards life. So those who have got of an active nature, always efficient, active, most of the people in modern times belong to this category. They have certain important duties to perform, responsibilities and obligations, social compulsions, different professions and so on. Now, this active tendency itself can be given a spiritual upliftment, a spiritual orientation. So our natural tendency to be active can be given a spiritual direction. So action is called in Sanskrit karma, and a spiritual link is called yoga. So karma becomes karma yoga when we do whatever we are doing with a sense of sanctity, with a sense of not indifference, but a kind of detachment. Detachment in the Karma Yoga context means not being obsessed, not being enslaved by our desire. We naturally will expect results for every action. And when we do our work with the great efficiency, we get the result. But our mind should not be obsessed by the desire for enjoying the results. It should not be enslaved by extreme desire to enjoy the results of what we do. So again, it doesn't mean any kind of lethargy or negligence. What it means is the ability to detach the mind to a higher spiritual ideal even while working hard with a definite motive and purpose. That is called Karma Yoga. This is one of the paths mentioned in the Gita. The another path, another direction in spiritual life is called Bhakti Yoga. Those who are traditional, conventional devotees of God, in any religious tradition, whatever may be their religious tradition, they have their own rituals, their own liturgy, their own sacraments, their own holy scriptures. All these are equally great. Vedanta considers all religions as so many paths leading to the same goal. All the different names are different names indicating the one supreme spiritual destination, which is universal. So the question is, how to give a spiritual link, a spiritual direction to our natural faith and piety. As I mentioned earlier, Vedanta is not a part of a conventional religious dogma. It is a universal approach to the whole philosophy of life. So the second yoga is bhakti yoga. So whatever may be our religious tradition, whatever may be the rituals we follow, whatever holy scriptures we may be reading, whatever may be the kind of worship we are doing, all these can be given a higher spiritual direction. So at the beginning, that's common for every beginner in spiritual life. We all begin with some external practices. A Hindu may go to a temple, perform rituals. So also a Christian may go to the church. And like that, Buddhist may go to Buddhist places. Like that, all religious traditions have their own holy scriptures, their own great saints and prophets and rituals, which are equally respected, which are equally sacred, which are equally universal. This is Vedanta approach. But as we evolve in our spiritual life, we should be able to experience the presence of God, not only inside the place of worship, but also outside the place of worship. We should be able to practice higher religion. Religion means spirituality in the higher sense. Not only for a few hours in the morning and evening, or for a few days every month, rather, true religion can be practiced every minute, in every action, in every thought. That means there is no need of a line of demarcation between the secular and spiritual. So at the beginning, as a kindergarten child may have to begin with the kindergarten, the primary school and so on. So also the beginning of our spiritual evolution, at the beginning of evolution, rituals, theology, the mythology, parables, all these are important, they are sacred, they are very, very relevant. But we should not stop there, just as we should not stop our education in the kindergarten. Our purpose is to go to Harvard or Stanford, wherever it may be. So it's a goal that corresponds to higher experience. So as we evolve in spiritual life, we should be able to see and feel the presence of God, not only inside the place of worship, not only when we read the Holy Scripture, but also when you are working in the factory, when you are teaching in a university, when you are working in a hospital, in the so-called secular world. So the line of demarcation between the secular and spiritual disappears. The secular becomes spiritual. Frequently, you know, spiritual becomes secular. That's a tragedy of many conventional religions throughout history. Even the spiritual becomes secular. But Vedanta, the Lord Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita tells, the secular becomes spiritual. When this happens, we'll be able to see the presence of God everywhere, and we'll be able to look upon the whole humanity as one spiritual family. In one of the great devotional classics of Hinduism, there's a discussion between a philosopher king and nine sages. So the king asks these sages, one of them answers, who is the highest devotee of God? Whom does God consider to be the most highly evolved person? Normally we may expect somebody who is very, very punctual in going to temples and perform rituals, puja and all that, who is a vegetarian. These are some of our ideas normally. It's the wrong ideas, of course. So these are some of the conventional ideas. But the answer is something very interesting. The answer is, the one who feels the presence of God in everything and everywhere, in every action and every word, and the one who feels the presence of the whole humanity and creation in God, you should be able to see the presence of God in everyone and the presence of everyone in God. So looking upon the whole humanity as one spiritual family. and whole life as a spiritual pilgrimage, so that the dividing line between the secular and spiritual disappears. He is the highest devotee. The verse is Sarva Bhudeshu Yapashet Bhagavad Bhavam Atmanaha Bhudani Bhagavad Yatmani Esha Bhagavadottamaha. This is the verse from the ancient classic. What it means is this. The highest devotee is one who doesn't consider external rituals or profession of faith at the end of religion, but rather he looks upon the whole humanity as one spiritual family. He is the highest devotee. Is the answer. This is the essence of bhakti yoga. At this level, we go beyond rituals, dogmas, theology, philosophy, and when we reach the experience level, you find all the great mystics, the highest devotees in all traditions, speak of the same experience but using different languages, different vocabularies. This is the essence of bhakti yoga. So this is the second approach discussed in the Gita. The third approach is called jnana yoga. There you don't deny God or karma yoga. What happens is, it is the approach of the philosopher. Maybe great scientist and many, many agnostic philosophers who are unwilling to put their belief in a creator God, who criticize creationism and so on, they can use this method and still they will be convinced that there is one divine reality present everywhere and in everything, which is something they cannot deny. So now we will have interaction for about 10 minutes. 10-12 minutes we have interaction. Those of you who would like to answer, to put questions, you are most welcome. Any questions from any direction, most welcome.
Swamiji, yeah. What is the Vedantic view of divinity as opposed to God?
Yeah. God is the approximation, the highest approximation in our spiritual evolution before we reach the non-dualistic experience. So one may believe in a traditional set of rituals and practices, give a name to his God, read holy scriptures, that is fine, wonderful. But if that person is a very sincere, very earnest, very committed spiritual seeker, a seeker of truth, then at one stage in his evolution, that God himself will take him to a state beyond God, the defined God, the conventional God idea. That's what you find in Eckhart. It will be the great example in Christian mysticism is Eckhart. Yeah. So he did not deny. See, when you reach Stanford, you don't say, oh, these children who study in kindergarten or primary schools are wrong. You don't say. Only you study something more of what you studied earlier. So, the divine reality as present in all of us, as present in everyone, signifying the universe, the spiritual universal oneness and unity of creation, that is a state of experience that every sincere seeker in any religious tradition is bound to reach. So there is one stage when you cross the barriers of belief systems and conventions. Frequently, such great mystics may not be fully recognized during the lifetime. Many were recognized, many were not. But what Lord Krishna says is, that should be the highest goal. In fact, once you have that goal in mind, you cannot be a fanatic. You cannot be narrow-minded. Because you know, the other person, you are studying in one kindergarten, another person is studying, child is studying in another kindergarten. You may fight. But your father, who is a professor, will not fight. Because he knows that all these children eventually come to Stanford. But when you are studying in two kindergartens, you think what you are studying is different or superior to what your friend is studying. So at the early levels of spiritual evolution, there can be differences of opinions and quarrels. But at the highest experience level, going beyond ritual, the level of rituals, going beyond the level of beliefs, belief systems, when you reach the experience level, there cannot be any kind of difference. There'll be perfect harmony. It's a matter of experience. It's not a matter of belief. See, belief is only the kindergarten in religious life. Experience is the highest goal. Belief is needed, no doubt. But experience is the highest goal.
If we are all born with this capacity to love, and it's one of the highest vibrations, why is our world tragically always in fear and war?
That's true. You know, Vedanta tells us that we gather different tendencies, impressions, samskaras. Whatever we do, it will create an impression in the mental system. And the Vedantic tradition, including Gita, believes in the law of karma and the doctrine of reincarnation. So once you believe that, we will be able to neutralize some of the negative tendencies in our own character, in our own behavior. So every negative tendency can be neutralized by developing a positive tendency. And as for the existence of evil, what we call existence of the unpleasant, we can only counteract by our own, by making our own efforts, by evolving ourselves. There are certainly people, and there are things which are essentially unpleasant, the tragic, the unpleasant. But there are also grand, great examples of saintliness, goodness also. So as the number of those who have these higher spiritual qualities increases, there will be a higher percentage of good qualities, good men and good women in the world. That's the idea behind. Vedanta doesn't accept the theory, the doctrine of evil. In the sense, it is because of some evil force or Satan or devil that there are problems in the world. Vedanta tells us that it is the result of our incomplete evolution. So every person has within him good and bad. And in some persons there may be a predominance of the evil and unpleasant. That's a fact, no doubt. But then there are persons who are essentially good also. Great examples to find. So we can actually rewrite our own character, our own destiny. Reprogram our own life by imbibing good qualities, good actions, good thoughts, good words. That's Vedantic approach.
In the present yuga, the Kali Yuga, to accelerate the evolution of our Atman, is there any magic soma available?
I should explain, because the Kali Yuga may be a term that's not familiar to me, a good number of our friends or somebody. Kali Yuga, in the mythological Hindu tradition, they have this belief of different ages, different eras. So we are right now in a very precarious condition. It's called Kali Yuga, where the percentage of the negative values predominate in this modern age. So it is called Kali Yuga. So the question is, there is any magic solution? Really, there is no magic solution. But in this modern era, you know, there is one advantage. Everyone has access to great ideas. Great ideas, you know. Everyone can have access if he or she wants. It was never so earlier. So this universalization of ideas, the universal access that you have to ideas, good and bad, can be turned to your advantage, actually. And again, the idea that you can be essentially good if you want, that possibility is always there. One can always make his own or her own individual effort to study and evolve. In the earlier eras, maybe some thousands of years back, there were vertical barriers that denied your access to higher ideas. But now, it's available, it's open to everyone. Maybe that's one important blessings of modern science and technology. People criticize science and technology and their explosive developments. But it can be a great blessing, can be turned into a great blessing for the good of humanity, for spiritual progress of humanity. It can be done. So these ideas are available and accessible to a vast number of people without much effort. So that is one advantage of modern times. So now I shall just speak a few more words about the third chapter. The third chapter is called Karma Yoga. At the beginning itself, you find the teacher tells us something very interesting. We cannot keep quiet for one split second. Even if you are physically inactive, mentally will be active. We'll be thinking, contemplating, planning and so on. So physically and intellectually and mentally, we cannot remain inactive even for a split second. So the teaching says, Nahi kasikshanamavi jadu dishtadi akarma krita. Karidehi avasa karma sarva prakrityehi gunehi. It's a Sanskrit verse. What it means is, we cannot keep quiet, remain inactive mentally and physically at the same time, even for a split second. At the same time, every kind of action can bring some unpleasant results if we are not very careful. So, there is a kind of helplessness to our mind. So, unless we try to feed our mind with good ideas, good thoughts, giving our mind good food, spiritual food, and giving our life and actions a spiritual orientation, then mind may choose its own food, which may be poisonous. So, feeding our mind, a mental constitution, with good ideas, positive ideas, ideas that are helpful in our own life, our personal life, and also good for others. That is the beginning of spiritual life. If we don't do that, then our natural tendencies will start dictating terms to our mind. And then Lord Krishna unfolds a unique strategy, a method of gradually bringing a spiritual element into every moment of our life, every action and every word. The advantage of that practice is you are able to practice action and contemplation simultaneously. We are able to combine action and contemplation. Very challenging situation, successfully facing a challenging situation without the mind, our mind going out of the way, without the mind being depressed. So, how to bring in the spiritual element by evolving a higher ideal? that will guide our thoughts and ideas and words. And this is possible for everyone. And Lord Krishna tells you something very interesting. He doesn't ask us to believe in a God to do this. That is something very interesting in this. So in this case, he is almost a bit of an agnostic like Buddha. He doesn't bring the idea of a particular God or goddess or any kind of dogmatic or theological baggage. He directly addresses the problem of man and woman in his or her everyday life situations and explains how a spiritual idea can be brought into play in our everyday life. So that is the major theme going to be discussed in the next chapter that will begin in the next session. Before conclusion, there is an announcement. There will not be a class next Friday, that is October 4th, because we have a festival, we have a celebration, Durga Puja, on Saturday, on 5th. So, we have to make preparations for the celebration on October 5th. There will be no class on October 4th. That means the next class will be on Friday, October 11th at 7:30 p.m. You're most welcome. Om Shanti 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 Harihi Om Tat Sat Sri Ramakrishna Arpanamastu.